This interview is taking place on November the 17th in Victoria, BC. The interviewer is Judith Gertson at the University of Victoria, and the interviewee is Mr. Alfred Le Reverend. Mr. Le Reverend, I wonder if you could just give me some background, when you were born, your place of birth, and where you went to school.
Yes, I was born in Kitchener, Ontario in 1926. I went to school in Toronto and London, Ontario.
What kind of, what level of schooling did you achieve?
High school.
High school.
No, grade 9. And then I joined at 16, so I left high school to join the forces.
So was that a legal joining, or did you?
No, I lied my age to get in.
How did you manage to get away with that?
It wasn't difficult during the war. In 1940, the government came up with the Registration Act, and everyone at the age of 16 had to register and carry a card at all times, a registration card at all times. And they were printed in 1940, and it was all they did was cross out the zero on the and put a 2 when I registered. And of course, it wasn't very difficult to eradicate the ink, which made my age 1940. And that's what I used to get into the Army, and they didn't question it.
So you were only 16?
Yes.
And what happened first? Where did you go first?
Well, I took my basic training in Chatham, Ontario, in infantry. And I took my advanced training at Ipperwash, Ontario, because I lived in London at the time. And from there, I went overseas to England.
And what kind of a mission? What kind of missions were you on from England?
In England, it was rather an odd thing. I had learned to type. One of the teachers convinced us that typing was a good thing to have, and I'm very grateful to him because it did help out a lot. In England, we were training in a holding unit. And it was getting a little monotonous, and it didn't, in the field, we used to call the regiments being in the field, the common expression. And it was very difficult to get to the field. And one day on parade, they asked if any of the people could type, put their hands up, so I did. I said, I'll get out of here for a while. And I worked in a records office for a holding unit. And so I, until September 44, I clerked in a records office, and typing. Very dangerous. And, well, you got paper cuts and whatnot. And, but I had applied to go to a regiment while I was there, and they, once they got a hold of you as a typist, if you were any good at all, they hung on to you. So I did manage. They promised they would let me go when they got a replacement for me. And by this time, the second front had opened up. I missed drafts for Italy, and I even put myself on a draft there in Italy one time when I was making up the nominal role, but they found out. But I did manage to get to the second front. The it was quite an experience. Yeah, I was wondering, when you're young, and if your father had been in World War I, you always heard these talk about the front, the line, they all up in the line, you're behind the line, in front of the line, and what the devil was this line? And so you, in your mind, you form some idea of what the line is like. And everybody's wrong. It's never as you imagine it. And in my book, I describe that, what the line is, what a regiment is like, your first impressions. being in the Army, you think, well, you know the Army, you've been in, you're trained, and you've been with troops for so long. But when you get to the front, into a frontline regiment, everything changes. People look different. They look different, they act different, they are different. And I explain in the book, my first impression that I had was not seen, but smells. Gasoline and manure. Because those are the two most, I suppose, incredible things. You had gasoline was used in your cook stoves, these stainless steel pressure cookers that the companies use for cooking food, and they were generally in a farmhouse or in a barn where there's always plenty of manure around. And the people, as you look around, they were so they looked like nothing I'd ever seen before, the troops. Because I suppose they slept in their uniforms, they were all carrying sidearms, pistols and whatnot, which was just taboo in the Canadian Army. But everybody had a pistol, which they had captured from the Germans had a lot of pistols they issued. No one was wearing any rank. You couldn't tell the officers from the privates, because the officers wouldn't wear their ranks at the front. And there was no saluting. They wouldn't accept a salute. They didn't want any sniper to see being saluted. So it was rather odd. And they behaved differently. When you put a group of young men anywhere, you see a lot of horseplay. People have to establish their pecking order. That was all gone. Nobody tried to establish, because it was already established the first time they went into action. People behave under fire to the best of their abilities, generally. And that best of their ability differs from people to people, person to person. Some people can behave extraordinary under fire, and others can just manage to carry out their duties, and that's all. And that is established the first time they're in action. And so the pecking order is established permanently after that. And because they're in a fighting mode, terrified most of the time, you never saw anybody pick fights at the front. No one wanted to waste time and that sort of thing. So if you see people coming back after the war who are aggressive, wanting to fight, those people had never been in action. Chances are nobody was aggressive. And there was no horseplay. Things were too serious. People were being killed all the time. And you didn't know, never knew when your number was up or going to be coming up. And many people, everyone has that mantle of immortality, which allows them to join in the first place and go to the front. They want to get to the front. But that disappears rapidly when you get to the front, that protective mantle. And that makes it all the more difficult. And people, I've had fellows say to me, I have a premonition, I'm going to die. And chances are they did. So these people were different. They behaved different. And that's what the first thing I saw when I got there that really impressed me. And there was a strong bond of camaraderie. Strong bond in a situation like that. And outsiders just couldn't penetrate that bond. The only way you could penetrate that bond was through attrition. When you'd proved yourself and you were everybody around you had gone, then they'd accept you.
So how long were you at the front?
Just a month. By that time I was one of the old hands.
those friendships, those bonds that you developed then, did they last beyond the war?
No, I never saw any hardly any of the chaps that I was with. In fact, I don't think I saw any of them again after I got back to Canada. But that bond was still there. But you do bond with people whom you don't know. I was wounded and taken prisoner. So I have chaps here, two chaps here in Victoria that were in my prison camp, and we worked in a salt mine, and they're here. So we have a prisoner of war association I belong to, and we get together for lunches and things like that. We have a very strong club here, which we enjoy.
Tell me about those events leading up to your capture. How did that come about?
It was like a movie. We had taken the town of Eschen, which is a town on the Belgian-Holland border. It straddled the border, Eschen. It's in the book. And we waited there for reinforcements, and for about 3 days had a rest. And then in the afternoon of the 24th of October, our company was told to go out to make an attack just outside the town to relieve, just to take pressure off the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, which was a sister regiment in our brigade. And that morning they had been mauled badly, and so we went out to just to take the pressure off them, that's all. And they told us, they never told us anything. We never, you know, we weren't even led, we were pushed, you know. And we walked outside the town, marched outside the town, about a mile, and we formed up off the ditch into this big long field. And our platoon was lead platoon, and we formed up in three ranks, open order, in skirmish line. Told us to fix bayonets, and they said, now down there, about 2,000 yards down there, you can see a copse of woods, and that's your objective. It was a long, open field, turnip field, very, very soft ground. And we had, I believe, four tanks from the Grenadier Guards, and these two of them had flamethrowers on, and they were told that they were in giving us support. And we were to go down there, and there was a farmhouse midway between us and that copse of woods. And we started down, and then nothing happening. We just went at a walking pace. And of course, you were 6 feet intervals, your people, 6 feet. So your line was quite extended. Three lines, three waves, our platoon. And then the tanks bogged down. They couldn't, in the field, so we had no support. They went down. And then the shelling started. Heavy shelling, and mortars, and then we realized that there were two lines of German trenches in front of those woods, facing us. And they were firing at us with small arms. Of course, we couldn't fire back because there's nothing to shoot at. So, by the time we got down to the copse of woods, there were 13 of us left. But we took the woods and we took the prisoners. As we got, we thought we were going to have to dig them up with bayonets, but when we got about 20 feet away from them, they came out of the trenches with their hands up, having shot us all the way down. But you know, I never saw a prisoner shot. I never saw anybody kill a prisoner. I had heard of it, but I'd never seen it. not in our regiment at any rate. We treated them badly. We didn't treat them with kid gloves. But we never overly abused them. We never shot them or anything like that. But at any rate, we took them prisoner and sent them back with walking wounded, generally, under guard. And we, by the time we got down there, we were hot, we were tired and exhausted, and I say terrified. And we kneeled down in the woods and took our hats off and wiped perspiration from our faces. And the chap in front of me started swearing, and I said, he's saying, "Oh God, oh God." I said, "What's the matter?" Now there were explosions all around us, mortars falling, so he didn't pay any attention to any particular explosion. The ground was soft, so the casualties were light in that respect. The ground took up a lot of the explosions, and there was an explosion off to my left, probably no more than 12 feet away, which I never even paid any attention. I was watching them, and this is when he started moaning. I said, "Are you hit?" He says, "No." He says, "For Christ's sake, look." And where this last explosion went, he was right on top of one of our chaps who was kneeling there. A chap by the name of Fennel from Montreal. And, of course, you can imagine there's only half of them left. We had a brand new lieutenant came up that morning. He was one of the replacements. And why our company commander sent him in the lead, I don't know. But it seems to me this is what they did. Recruits, or not recruits, but new people coming up the line, they were the ones that always got shoved in first into the most dangerous positions. And this is why they talk about cannon fodder. They arranged it like that. They saved their people who were friends of theirs and whatnot and shoved in the replacements. And this lieutenant came up that morning. You know, 2 hours later, he was captured. And, however, we, as I said, took the woods, kneeled down, we were waiting, and he says, "I think we should go down and take," there was a railway line going down, he said, "I think we should go down and take that railway line." You know, we looked at each other and thought, God, you know, what if we get down there, what if we do take it, we can't hold it. We didn't have any automatic weapons left. And we had no support. They couldn't even see us from the other side of the woods. So, anyway, there's nothing you can do. You can't argue with a lieutenant under fire. That's a no-no. So anyway, this is about probably 100, 200 yards away, down, further down. Of course, and they really opened up on us when we started down there. Of course, we were just like broken field running. We were just running for our lives to get to that ditch down there and hide behind it. And we lost. I was hit, and another chap was killed going down there for no reason at all. But at any rate, we got down to that ditch, and he saw that it was impossible. What had happened, we didn't even know this, but we were right in the middle of a squadron or a company headquarters, the German headquarters. We didn't know this. There was a farmhouse down there, and that was their headquarters building, and they didn't like it. And they had tanks dug in. This is what we'd been fighting, dug in tanks. We could see it when we got down there. Dug in tanks, and they were firing point blank at us. So we thought, well, the ditch was probably about 3 feet deep, and it was half full of water. And we were going along on our bellies in this, trying to keep our behinds and heads down, because they were firing at us. And I can remember little frogs ahead of me being pushed along with the water in front of me, and we were trying to get back on the field and go back to the woods and with our heads down, and they're firing at us, and first thing we know, they were all around us. So the lieutenant says, we have to surrender. There's nothing we can do. So we came up with our hands up. And the first thing a person does when you have a prisoner is just search them for weapons. That's the first thing. Grenades and things like that. And they just gave us a cursory search, told us to put our hands down. I had received that morning, or the morning before, a carton of cigarettes. And of course, my section, we used to share them. Each of them had a package of cigarettes, Canadian cigarettes, and I had one in each pouch, cigarettes, not even opened. And the German came and he took out the cigarettes, he took the cellophane off, he opened up the thing and he took half the deck out and put German cigarettes back in it and put it in my pocket. I couldn't believe it. We stripped them of everything. And then they told us to put our hands down, and they took me to to a first field dressing station, which was the most terrible thing I had ever seen in my life. It was a one-story brick school that they converted to a first field dressing station. And the ambulances coming into that place couldn't even get close to the school. The schoolyard and the hallways were just full of stretchers. And it was the most terrible thing you ever saw. And the sounds emanating from these poor beggars. And I was the only Allied soldier there, and I felt as though I was responsible for the whole thing. You know, you have this mantle of guilt and fear that they're going to take a reprisal out on you. But, you know, they were so friendly. And they looked after me. I even got priority. They took me into the operating room, and first thing you know, I was out lying on a mattress in the rooms. That's all they had, were mattresses on the floor, you know, in school. And I had the best meal I'd ever had since leaving Canada in that place there. I remember I had beef and potatoes and some kind of green vegetable. And then after that, they came around with a handful of candies, and they gave me one candy and a cigar. And one of the orderlies, or the nurses, came out, and he stopped on a pretext of checking my bandages, but he just wanted to talk to me. A lot of them spoke English very well. And he said, you'll be well looked after. He says, don't try to escape. He says, or they'll shoot you. And as I mentioned in the book, by this time I had been fed, and everybody was friendly. I said, cripes, it's escape? If the recruiting sergeant had come through, I'd have tackled him. I wouldn't have been treated better if I'd been picked up by our own people. They treated us very well. But we did happen to, they weren't SS, they were professional fighters, armored people, and they treated me quite well. And then they sent me to a hospital further back into Holland, a town called Dordrecht. And I was there for about a week. And it was another school, two-story school, and we had a nice room up in the second story, and there was probably about a dozen prisoners there, Canadian and British. But we were well treated there too.
They treat the British as well as the Canadians
as
equal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then from there they put us on a train and took us into Germany, on a hospital train, in the boxcars. And they had the boxcars, you know, the very small boxcars. They're called 40 and 8s. Have you ever heard that expression? On the side of the boxcar, these were standard right throughout Europe. 40 men or 8 horses. So we call them 40 and 8s. Small, you've seen pictures of these small boxcars, okay. Now they had stretchers built in around on the walls and each end. And in each boxcar, under a German orderly looked after the wounded. And they put one prisoner in each boxcar for security reasons, I suppose. And we were on that train for a night and a day. All night, and then that's right, and the next late afternoon we got into Germany, into a town called Lingen, to a big prisoner of war hospital there. And of course, there we left the Germans, left the German hospitals and the orderlies and whatnot, and we realized just what it's going to be like as a prisoner, because the rations, prisoner of war rations we got there, and which was next to, almost next to nothing. It was terrible. And paper bandages, that's all they had. And after that, and we got from there, we went on to into a prison camp, a place called Fallenbostel, Stalag 11B. And there was another one, Stalag 357, was there as well. And there was a Russian camp as well. So it was a pretty big structure there. And it was very Spartan, to say the least. You had no heat. You were fed once a day, a bowl of soup, a slice of bread, sometimes two boiled potatoes, and that was it. That's all you lived on. Red Cross parcels by that time, towards the end of the war like that, was few and far between. I think I can remember maybe three Red Cross parcels shared between four men. So that you're hungry all the time, and then they cleared all the Canadians out of about just after Christmas in 1944. They cleared all Canadians and put us to work in the salt mines.
Where was that located?
Probably no more than 80 kilometers, I suppose, from where the Stalag was, up in the Lunenburger Heide area in Westphalia. And that, to me, was a terrible experience. I suffered with claustrophobia. And it was nice and warm down there. We were quite far down in the bowels of the earth. But what we were really, really building, it was all rock salt, and what we were really building was an underground factory. Huge big rooms. And I would say it would be atomic bomb proof, so far down. They had been building that for years and years and years. There were chaps, German prisoners, political prisoners, most of them, and a lot of them were professors, things like this, and they lived down there. They came up once on Sunday for a shower, and then they could see daylight. And they lived down there, and some of them have been down there since 1933. So that was about the gist of my experience there. I did escape. Myself and another chap named Herbert Hansberger from Beamsville, Ontario. Towards the end of the war, things were pretty disorganized, so it wasn't really that significant an operation. We were 3 days. We marched, the two pair of us, sleeping in the afternoon, walking at night, and we met up with the British Guards Division. So. But anyway, it saved us going on what they call the march, because we had been warned to get ready to go. So that's why I escaped. I didn't want to go on that march.
What did the march entail?
Have you not done?
No. Tell me about the march.
It happened to just about all prisoners, and some of them started much earlier. Those on the eastern front. When the Russians were coming, they evacuated all the camps and just kept them marching. no specific destination, just kept them walking. A lot of people died on that thing, and exposure, starvation and whatnot, a lot of people.
How did they feed them? They just take food from towns that they've passed
through? A lot of them, they just had to scrounge what they could on the road. It was a dreadful thing. Lost a lot of prisoners through that. Yes, I'm surprised you haven't run into these. Because have you spoken to any prisoners before?
The only one that I've spoken to was a German officer who was captured by the Russians.
So oh, I see.
Different situation.
He wouldn't have had a very good time either. Terrible. There were worse.